Okay. So, you know, the slides are finished. The lectures are over for this half of the course. So, I have a couple of words to say about exams, and it might be helpful if I went through a past exam question, sort of pointing out, you know, how I'd expect it to be answered. Any questions about anything on the course? Is there a lecture on Thursday? I don't know. Ask KK. I don't know. I saw him today. I didn't ask him. So, I don't know.
Sorry?
What? Am I in the UCU? I'm in the UCU, yes.
Okay, that's probably no lecture, right?
So, but I don't lecture on Thursdays, so. Any more questions? Let me make, you may all think this is an obvious point, but I would like to make it. So we have a course called Inf2B. What do we have in this course? We have notes. We have lectures. And their slides. We have tutorial questions, or we have tutorials and their questions. We have coursework. Have I missed anything? Ah, that's the next thing. The exam. Very good. The point I would like to make is that sometimes some people mistakenly believe that we just have this sort of dependency between the course and the exam. I would like to make the point that there are these dependencies as well. So the point I'm making is that the course, the notes, of course, are the kind of really solid core of the course and the core to any work you do for the exam. Particularly, certainly on my half, possibly on KK half, there is stuff that was done in the lectures and is on the lecture slides, examples, for an example, that aren't in the notes, but that's part of the course. There are weekly tutorials, which I'm sure everybody here, of course, turns up to their tutorials every week. And there are questions to those tutorials. It should not surprise you to, we are nice people, we are not nasty people. So it should not surprise you to know that a really good way to get a sort of feel for the sort of questions you get on exams is to look at the tutorial questions. And, you know, it's meant to, you know, what we do in the exam is meant to reflect what's done in the course, and it's sort of what's done in the whole course. So again, the tutorials are sort of part of the learning experience that we hopefully can, you know, will play a part in the exam. And to a lesser extent, the coursework as well, although that's a much lesser extent. But certainly, it's not just the notes, it's the lectures and the slides, I'm a big believer in lecture recording, so I'm really sorry that these lectures weren't recorded, because I know a lot of people use them, it's really helpful. But even so, the slides are available, there is some additional stuff on the slide, so make sure to take that into account. And of course, the copious notes he took during the lectures. And the tutorials and the questions. And you know, if you didn't do a question for a tutorial, think of that as you can now use it to your advantage when you come to do your revision, because you'll have new material to test yourself on. But if you did do them, come back to them again, because, you know, week two was a long time ago. So I may be stating the blindly obvious to you, but really. All those things are helpful. One more thing is that
on a date to be decided. There'll be a revision lecture, well, a revision, well, like a 2-hour session, half of KK and an hour of KK and an hour of me. Probably, it usually happens at a sort of more or less convenient time, 1 or 2 weeks before the exam, and we try to work out when such a convenient time might be, given all the other courses everybody does between you. So, even though, and it's quite reasonable that you sort of don't come here with specific questions because it's kind of a busy time of year, and you like have coursework and things to do. When it gets closer to the exam, you know, in a couple of weeks, when you've done all your coursework and you start kind of looking back at the different courses, do sort of take notes about things you might like to bring up at the revision lecture. And you know, it's much better to come with specific questions than to have a question whose answer is essentially, you know, a question which is, please repeat lectures 8, 9, and 10 is kind of not a helpful question at a revision lecture, because the best you're going to get is a kind of speeded up version. I can talk quite fast, but it doesn't help. But if you can come out with really specific questions, that's helpful. And it's helpful for everybody. The exam format's the same as last year, so there's no multiple choice questions in Inf2B. So there's 6 questions on the paper, 3 from KK side, 3 from my side, and you need to do 2 from each part. Any other, since we're talking about the exam, any questions about the exam? Yeah.
Do you have to remember all the formulae?
Do you have to remember all the formulae? It's helpful, yeah. I mean, I don't think, in a sense, I don't think there's that many, but there's some really important ones that can be helpful. So, yeah, if you can remember the formula for Gaussian, that's helpful. And you see, for a lot of things, right, so you remember the formula for Gaussian. Once you've got that, you can kind of work out what the log likely, you know, what the log probability is going to look like and what a discriminant function is going to look like and things like that. And that's fine. So, but the more things you learn, the less you have to work in an exam and the more time you have. So definitely remember the formula for a Gaussian. Very helpful to remember what the formula, what the log probability looks like. And then from that, you know, well, you know, that goes straight to a discriminant function. And then you can look at the ratio of them if it's a two-class thing. And if you remember them, or at least remember the shape of those things, that can really help in an exam because it just saves you time. It's useful. It's useful to remember the formula. And again, I mean, sometimes the formulae are indistinguishable from the concepts in a way. So if you think in terms of like naive Bayes, if you've got a question about what's naive Bayes, then you know the absolute, a very precise way of answering it is saying, well, if we've got a distribution, you know, px1, px2, px1, x2, x3. Then the naive Bayes assumption is that, you know, this equals probability of x1, probability of x2, probability of x3. In a sense, that's learning a formula, right? But it's kind of also understanding naive Bayes. So, yes, it's useful. So I think a Gaussian is an example of a formula you need to learn. I don't think there's that many which are like that. But there's a lot of things where I think, you know, I hope you might... It might help your understanding by being able to express them mathematically the same way they're expressed in the lectures. And it also means you can write a much more precise answer because for many things we're asked you to explain something. An equation can really help, that can you know really nail an answer quickly. Any other questions? What else was I going to say? You've done enough exams to know about exam technique, but it has certainly been the case in the past, although we don't try to make it this way, that people have come into
issues that they feel under time pressure when they're doing an exam. So try and use a bit of time management when you do an exam, because very often the sort of best use of time is that, you know, there are certain things which you do and you get quite a lot of marks for, and then there are other things where you're kind of thinking about something and trying to get something right. And it's not worth spending, you know, if you've got to answer four questions in an exam, it's not worth spending half the exam on one question, because it's not going to get you, it's not going to maximise your marks. So try and manage your time in an exam. And I know it's hard, and I know sometimes you can get into a situation where you think, oh, if I just work at it, I know I can do this. But you've got to be kind of quite tough with yourself sometimes, because you want to make sure that everything you can do straight away, or you can do relatively quickly across four questions, you do. So do try and manage your time in an exam. Any other questions? Yeah.
Do you have any specific particular questions we could possibly work on now with regards to neural nets and building them up? So I felt that was something I was struggling with.
So there's questions on past papers about that.
I was wondering if you possibly go through one.
Yeah, sure. I've got one. Yep. Okay, hang on. Everybody happy to do this? To spend 20? Yeah, I can see nods going, but you were sitting right next to him, so of course. Yeah. It could just be something about that area of the room. Good. Let me do that. Does that work? Yeah, cool. Let me do the following then. So that's as big as it's going to go, really. Is that okay? So this was from last year's exam. Yeah, I'd forgotten what year it was. I had a sudden horrible feeling I'd put up this year's exam, but it isn't. So it's okay. I don't even have it on an unencrypted disk. So, but you know how it is. I still 2010. I've got 2010. Oh dear. But it's 2011, so it's okay. This is from the 2010 paper. Here we have. This was a question. Yeah, okay. So, what do we have? We've got consider a single layer neural network used for classification with d-dimensional input vectors and C output classes. So very often, you know, the preamble of a question is just to establish the notation you're going to use. The network is trained using a sum of squares error function. So this is absolutely standard. It's what's been in the notes. So part one for 2 marks is write down the equation for the network output y in terms of the input vector x and the weight matrix w, and state any assumptions you make. So, you know, you can actually just write this down. So part one, you just basically write down y equals wx, and the assumption you might make is x is like d plus one dimensional, because x0 equals 1 because it's the bias. So that's just, you know, straight from the notes. What's the next question? Given a training set of n inputs and their target outputs, explain how the network can be iteratively trained, giving the necessary equations to update the weight connecting input I to output k. So this is So this question again, I'm just going through the whole question. So the first two bits are kind of like talk work, but it's worth I'll talk about this because it's some people sometimes have a habit of just putting of what you know the phrase gold plating? So gold plating is when somebody asks you to do something, and you say, okay, I can do that, but I can do more. Let me show you how good I am, and you do it really, really, really well. Exams are a lot of times for gold plating, because if I ask you to do something in an exam for 2 marks, that's what I've asked you to do. And you can tell me lots and lots of other things, and I might be deeply impressed with your knowledge, but unfortunately, if I haven't asked you to do it, you're not going to get any extra marks. So really, answer the question as set. So anyway, the next thing is, given a training set of, as a general life rule, gold plating often occurs when you're dealing with some kind of bureaucracy and they've got some kind of constraints on you, and you want to show what a good guy you are, so you put more constraints on yourself, and they've never asked you to do this, and people do this, and it's an insane way to behave, because you're actually making life worse for yourself, rather than trying to make life as well as possible. You do not have to impress bureaucracies usually. Sorry, a bit of a rant. But you know, I felt I should try and give you one life lesson in the entire course. And one life lesson is don't gold plate. And indeed, in 10 years' time, it may be the only useful thing you got out of this course when you're like, you know, working in HR and being all touchy feely. But it's okay. I hope you don't all end in the title. So given a training set, let's target outputs, explain how computers should be trained, and give the necessary equations. Okay, so there's I would say to do this, you really want 3 parts. The first part is you want to say, well, we train to minimize an error function. And you can write down the error function, and you can say E, or you can say E, making very clear, it's a function of the white space. And this is, how might we actually want to write this? You might want to say that it's the sum of En of W, summing over all the training sets, which equals sum over n, sum over k, ynk plus tnk squared. And you would define very quickly what all these things are. If you don't define all these things, well, you know, you might be the mark or something. But the other thing is. You know, ideally you should be putting on all the limits on your sums, and it goes from 1 to n, and it goes from 1 to n, and k goes from 1 to big k. In practice, if it's, you know, it's usually clear what the summation limits are, so if you miss it, you know, everything else is right, it's clear what's going on is right, then you won't lose a mark. So that would be the first part. The next part, would be the gradient descent algorithm, so GDN algorithm, and then that would really just be straight from the notes. So one would be initialize W. Two would be compute the gradient, which you might write as grad W minus grad W E, and update weights in the direction negative of the gradient, and then three is like we can use error and go to two. So you'd sort of have an answer like that. And then you can say, well, in the part two, you can say that within this, it wants the necessary equation to update weight from I to K. So what you want to basically say is that W at T plus 1 of KI equals W at T of KI minus eta times the partial derivative of the partial error with respect to partial weight. So that gets you most of the way, and then for a complete answer, you want to write down that gradient. And you could, if you like, you could just write down the gradient for the end thing, because we know that that's a summation over that. I'm doing it for the end thing, so don't need summation. So that's just delta nk times xin, and you can say that what your delta k equals is yk minus dk. And that's basically everything you need for that question. This is sort of one of the things, right, where if you've learned this, and I think this kind of delta rule is a really easy thing to remember. If you've learned it, it says that's some one piece of differentiation you don't have to do in the exam, and it will save you a minute or two. And it's easy, this is the sort of thing that is for all your lecture training you've seen, we always end up with something of this form where you have the value of going into the weight multiplied by the error signal at the other end of the weight. In the case of a single layer network, where there's no transfer function, it's really straightforward, and then when you have transfer functions, right, you have this D prime thing. So that's just a little thing to remember. But then in the case of backprop, you've got the whole deal of doing this weighted sum of the output error signals to get the hidden unit error signal. So that's the answer for that part. This was an easy question, actually, because it actually had lots of book work in. So if you kind of like read and understood the notes, this is I think an easy question. It's actually gotten. So the general rule is that we try and make, and don't go back and count because it may not always hold, but we try and have across the entire exam 30 to 40%. Of the exam sort of being essentially book work, and the rest either applying book work or doing calculation or something. But it doesn't necessarily hold across questions. You may get a question which has a lot less book work, or a question which has a lot more book work. So that's just how it happens. So this is an example of a question which has really most of this is book work. Can't believe I wrote this. Anyway, what's the next question? I know why. I can tell you why. And don't necessarily. I have actually genuinely forgotten what's on this year's exam. So I can't give you hints like that. Is this true? Do you tend to get more book work on things that come later in the course? You might like to do an analysis of exams to see if that's true. I think it might be true. Anyway, what's the next question? Right. So consider a single layer network which has three dimensional inputs and a single output. Let the bias W0 equals minus 1 and the weights be 0.5 minus 1 and 0.5. And consider a particular training item, 0.5 minus 1, 1, with a target 1. So this is really just applying the equations. So the first part is compute the value of the network output for this input vector. That's easy. So what are the numbers? It's just minus 1 times 0.5 plus minus 1 times minus 1 plus 0.5 times 1, and that equals 0.75. So that's easy. It's helpful to show you're working. So and it's helpful. So if it's something that you need to do working, do it in your answer book. Don't just kind of write it on the question paper. Don't be embarrassed about showing your stupidity about having to do working, because we all have to do working, and we all make mistakes from time to time. And you don't actually, if you come out with the right thing, the fact you came on a slightly circuitous route to get there doesn't mean you're going to lose marks if you finally got the right route. It's okay. And they're anonymously marked anyway, so nobody's ever going to know it was you who couldn't add or something. So, but it's much better to show working, because then you can get partial marks. When you kind of have general kind of book, or, you know, when you have questions, if a question just says write down blah, write down the discriminant function, then it's okay to just write it down to say, you know, y of x equals blah. That is okay. If a question says derive, then you would normally expect to have more than just one line, maybe two or three lines, because you're deriving something. You're laughing, you think, oh, we never do this, but people do. And what's really, really annoying is people who do exams where they don't show working, and they usually kind of write down the right answer, so that's fine. And then it comes to quite a big bit of a question, and they write down the right answer, and there's nothing else. And you think, well, tough, you probably made a small mistake somewhere, but if you weren't willing to show your working, you will not get any marks. I'm not up to the high level of KK, as I said, explaining all the things you get no marks for, but I'm sure you can explain that in some detail. That kind of covers it for me. Suffice it to say, I am nodding in the background. Okay, so that's that bit. The next bit is compute the gradient of the error arising from this training item with respect to each weight in the bias. So this is a really easy question. It's not asking you to do the whole thing, it's just asking you to compute the gradient. So the first thing we want to do in this case is compute the delta. There's only one because it's just one output, so that's just 0.75 minus 1 equals minus 0.25. And then we need to go and compute the gradients. So we have partial E by partial W0. That equals delta dot x0, which is minus 0.25, and then we have partially by partial w1, which is delta by x1, that's minus 0.125, and so on. I guess you actually asked me a question about an NLP, weren't you, on the single layer network? Yeah, and I had an exam.
I'm not too sure about the next question about segwise as well. So
okay, that's cool. That's cool. I will carry on. So remember what it says. Compute the gradient of the error arising from this training item with respect to each weight in the bias. Then you need to compute. You need to compute four gradients. Because there's three weights and a bias, and you just need to go and show the. And these are really straightforward ones. Part B is sort of one of those questions, which I guess is part bookwork and part kind of testing your understanding of what's in the bookwork. So it says define the logistic sigmoid and sketch a graph. So. G of A equals 1 over 1 plus x put minus A. And then you can sketch a graph. So again, when you come to do graphs, you just need to have the sort of key features right. So sigmoid that goes something like this. So it's good to have some 0.5 there. One mark there and zero there, and you get the approximate shape. So, and you might want
So the question is, why is a sigmoid sometimes used as a transfer function to the output of a single layer network? There's a couple of things you can say. Bear in mind that this question is for 5 marks, and since it says define the logistic sigmoid function and sketch a graph of it, you know that the last part is going to have a maximum of 3 marks attached to it, right? Because you know there's got to be a mark for that, because I've asked you to do something, there's got to be a mark for that, because I've asked you to do something. So you know that you're only talking 3 marks here, so 3 marks doesn't mean an essay, right? So you could get the 3 marks basically for, I think, making 2 points, and if you made one point well, you'd get 2 marks. So I think the 2 points you want to make are, firstly, a sigmoid is used as a transfer function because you might want to have a function where you essentially have an output constraint to be between 0 and 1 at the output of the network. And think about a sigmoid in comparison to the step function is that it's differentiable, so you can do any kind of gradient-based training with it. With a step function, if it comes sometimes, it's obviously not differentiable. There are ways to train it, such as perceptron training, which we haven't covered, but that's one reason. Reason two is that you can show that if you're using the sigmoid as an output of a single layer network, then there's this relationship to the posterior probability. So if you train your network to be a classifier, so in this case you've got a one output network, you're using the sigmoid, and if you train it to be a two class classifier, one is for one class, zero is the other class, then using a sigmoid function, the output of that network can be interpreted as a posterior probability. So it's giving you the probability of a class given the data. And that's a good thing to have. If you don't use a sigmoid, then you don't have that, because the output of the network is just a weighted sum, right? So it doesn't have any constraints at all, so it can't be interpreted as a probability. So those are the two things that you would mention about why is a sigmoid used. Part three. Again, it's for 5 marks. So one of the limitations of single layer networks. So tell me, what are the limitations of single layer networks?
Linear.
Linear, yeah. So that's the big limitation. So but you can say, you know, so you get a couple of marks for that or a mark for that, whatever. But you can expand on that just a little bit to go and have some more detailed limitations. So if it's linear, it means you've got a very limited set of functions that it can. So by a limited set of functions, I mean, you know, your function is basically a discriminant function, and you can strain to a linear discriminant function, right? And we've seen in lots of examples, there are many examples where you need a bigger set of functions. So you've got a limited set of functions. Can only separate linearly separable data. I guess sort of related to that, if you wanted, you could say this is probably not required, that the decision boundaries must be hyperplanes. So it's all the basic things saying that they're linear, but it's helpful to add a sentence or two to explain the ramifications of what being linear means. Then the second part is, and of course, multi-layer networks don't have these drawbacks, and you can represent non-linear functions. So. Are there any drawbacks of multi-layer networks? More difficult to construct. Well,
it's got a larger amount of hidden layers that it's hard to guess what the weight is.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. You are always so. Yes. You're kind of putting two So the point about local minima is that a single layer network is basically a quadratic function, the error function is basically quadratic, so it's going to have a single minimum, whereas a multi-layer network can have, you know, some really complicated thing, which is a good thing, because you can one or more complicated things, but the bad thing is that you don't know if you train it perfectly. So it's more difficult to train, and then related to constructing it, you've kind of got, need to choose number of hidden units. You know, these things come and go, actually. So, multi-layer networks were very fashionable in the late 80s and sort of 90s, and then over the past decade or so, they became sort of less fashionable because of these problems. They're sort of harder to train. You don't have a kind of provably optimal training algorithm. You've got these what are called hyperparameters, like how many hidden units do you use, and there are other methods that seem to avoid these things. But it is still the case that these multi-layer networks, in many cases, prove to be you can just get better performance on real-world data. They can actually model the real-world functions that you want to model better than some of these other approaches. And it's sort of one of these things where you, on the one hand, you have, you know, very techniques haven't really covered here, but they're very mathematically elegant. They're kind of, you can prove things about the optimization. But on the other hand, it turns out they're just less powerful in some ways than what you get with multi-layer networks. So that's one thing. Also, you tend to end up with more parameters. So that's the mechanometer overtraining. You know, so with the multi-layer network, you have a lot of hidden units. You can end up with quite a lot of parameters, and maybe you don't have enough training data to constrain that. So that's what you'd need to do for that question. Anything else? Okay, we're done. Yes. Take this as a sort of homework exercise. You can show that if you have a function which is kind of related to exclusive OR, so you sort of have something like this. So you've got two classes, and this is the blue class. And this is the green class, so you have something like that. You can sort of very efficiently kind of model that, because you sort of have one layer which is sort of split into these boundaries, and then the next layer which is kind of joining them together to get an output. If you do it with a single layer of hidden units, it's possible to do it with arbitrary approximation, but you end up using an arbitrarily large number of hidden units, because you sort of end up with this funny sort of crenellated, how would it look? Sort of crenellated decision boundary like this, as you're getting more and more hidden units to do that. Do it on a piece of paper and play around with the weights and work out how it goes. So yeah, you can come with these examples,
and certainly can come up with examples of where two hidden layers are good. You can also come up with ideas where you can say, well, actually, we'd sort of like our hidden layers to do something. So what you can think of as the, you may wonder, so what's actually, how can I interpret what's going on with the hidden units? And one way to think of it is you can have a sort of probabilistic interpretation, and this is slightly hand-waving. But what do you have? Your hidden unit is basically sort of taking a weighted sum of the input, and it's doing a sigmoid, right? So you can think of that weighted sum of the input as kind of putting a template on top of the input, because it's basically that weighted sum is going to be big for some input configurations near it, and then it'll be sort of smaller. So if the input configuration matches the weights, so when the input unit's big and the weight is big, for those input configurations, that's going to give you the biggest weighted sum, the hidden unit. So you can sort of think of that as it kind of putting a template on it. And then, and this is where it gets actually slightly hand-waving, but what you can think of is, well, we're putting a sigmoid on this. So at least formally, you can think of these hidden units as sort of estimating some kind of probability. Now, it's obviously not a probability of any sort of class you've given to it, because those are associated output units. But these things are sort of like representations that help you along the way. So you can kind of think of the weights for a hidden unit as acting kind of like, collectively, they act as a feature detector for that hidden unit. It's looking for patterns of a particular type. Imagine you've got a kind of, it's sort of, the weights go onto an 8x8 array, and they've got a checkerboard pattern. So if the weights are big where you tend to have ones and small when you tend to have zeros and so on, then it's going to match those rather than the other way around. So you can think of each hidden unit as sort of being a detector of a particular type of feature. And given that it's gone through a sigmoid, you can think of these things as kind of giving you probabilities of a particular type of features. And a really cool thing, of course, is that you don't pre-specify in advance that those features have to be. So if you're doing optical character recognition, you know, some older approaches say, well, I want to look for things where there are angles like this, or there are right angles, whatever, and those are useful features. But when you're automatically training the weights, you hope, and you can, learn those features. So that's what hidden units are doing. They're kind of giving you probabilities of features. Now, you can think of kind of like having multiple layers of hidden units. Kind of gives you the opportunity to get richer and richer features. So you have your kind of bottom layer, and again, you know, just for the sake of argument, think in terms of pixels. So your first layer of hidden units is giving you kind of features at the pixel level, but those features you might be able to interpret them as some sort of shape type of features. So the next sort of layer might be looking at those and giving you features at a sort of higher level, and then you might get another level giving you kind of object level features, and then at the very top you're going to tell you. Something about the scene, something like that. So that's a really nice argument for why you might have many, many layers of hidden units. And that argument's been around for a long time. There've been psychology models like that since the 1950s. There was a sort of well-known, rather apocryphal model called the neocognitron, which is a wonderful name, which was developed by a researcher called Fukushima, who actually worked with the Japanese Broadcasting Company about 30 years ago. And that was kind of nice, it was very ad hoc. So people, of course, wanted to do this with NLPs. But the real problem is that it's really hard to train these things. So the reason it's really hard to train these things is that you have, if you've got lots of layers, it's a hard problem to the quite wide layers. You've got lots and lots of parameters to train. So that's one problem. The other problem you can come up with is that if you look at what happens when you do gradient descent, computing your gradients and you look at the error signals, they tend to get smaller and smaller as you go through the network. Particularly if you end up in a situation where you have to be taking into account the derivative of the transfer function, that's kind of causing things to get smaller. So you can end up with quite small gradient signals as you kind of go through the network. So because of that, because it was a hard error surface to train, using straightforward backpropagation has more or less failed to train it, unless you can really put some constraining things in. And there are some really nice examples of people who put particular constraints that they know about their problem.
problem, and it's impossible to train them. In the last few years, there's been an approach called deep belief networks, which is a very fancy name for accumulated ideas. And one of the really interesting ideas that's come out of these deep belief networks is an approach. It's an approach which basically allows you to what's called precondition the weights. So rather than just randomly initializing and then training using backpropagation, what deep belief networks give you is an approach where by using unsupervised data, you can basically get a much better initialization of the weights. And it still doesn't make training these deep networks that easy, but there have been some actually extremely promising results in the last couple of years of people managing to train really quite complex networks like this. The other thing about these things is that it's extremely compute intensive. So a lot of the things that have been done are just impossible to do unless you're basically using GPUs to do the computation. So the thing about GPUs is you can do really fascinating computation, which is what you need to do. So these things don't sort of parallelize that well across a huge cluster of discrete processors like you might get if you just have a network of fast PCs. But they do parallelize very well in a very tight way that you can get with a generalized graphics processing unit. That was a longer answer than I was planning to get. But there you go.
We're finished, good. Sorry?
When are the revision issues?
The date hasn't been set yet. I would say yes, but the exams start well before Easter, right, this year, because Easter's so, I mean, Easter's like the 25th. But it will be, depending on the date, one or 2 weeks before the exam.
Okay.